There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome.
We shall
It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Today, we honor a king.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Today in 1968, the world forever changed when an assassin's bullet struck down Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis. But 50 years later, King's dream survives.
My grandfather had a dream that his four little children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough.
That's Dr. King's granddaughter, Yolanda, speaking last month at the March for Our Lives rally in Washington, D.C. Today, we look back at King's legacy and the future of the civil rights movement. We also consider Dr. King's appearances on screens, large and small. All that's ahead, but first, we want to hear from you. What do you think is Dr. King's legacy? Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Lazarix Hill, Jr. I attend Morehouse College. I'm a freshman year student. Martin Luther King Jr. just always has been like a real like role model for me. I always try to strive to be more like him and just be fearless in my convictions. But like, he's part of the reason why I went to Morehouse College, because he just left us such a big legacy on the school. I just feel really blessed to be able to like follow in his footsteps in some sort of way, you know?
My name is Kiara White. I attend Clark Atlanta University. King's legacy means freedom, hope. Our generation should learn how to be more humble, more respectful, and have a lot more ambition like he did. He didn't give up. I feel like our generation gives up really easily, and I feel like we could do better in that area.
Hi, my name's Steven Aceto. I'm a student at Georgia Tech. I'm from Houston, Georgia. He was definitely a trailblazer. He set the path for a lot of great leaders. He was pretty much not the first of his kind, but really the first to take big steps forward for America, and it definitely wouldn't have been the same without him.
I'm Dr. Adrian Jones. I'm a political science professor here at Morehouse College. What does Martin Luther King mean to me? I think he provides a good example of someone who stood up for their ideals and did not back down, even sometimes in the face of violence. And I think that it is definitely possible that another Martin Luther King is among us, perhaps even here at Morehouse College.
Of course, we want to continue to hear from you. What does Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy mean to you? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. We begin today with someone who was there and who knew Dr. King well. Former journalist Zernona Clayton was the first woman of color to have her own Atlanta television show on WAGA-TV.
But I'm also everlasting friend of Martin Luther King. I'm in Atlanta at the invitation of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from 1963 to now.
Clayton worked with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SLIC for short, and was a close advisor to Dr. King. These days, she's CEO of the Trumpet Awards Foundation. Now in her late 80s, she remembers King as if it were yesterday. We joined her at her Atlanta office. She points to several pictures hanging on the wall of Dr. King. One shows her on stage with King in front of a large group of children. He's speaking in an Atlanta neighborhood with a lot of public housing.
I didn't feel that Dr. King had a relationship with the people he preached about, you know, the poor kids, so to speak. So I said, Dr. King, let's have a Christmas party and invite the children and have a big party for the kids. And you could be Santa Claus. And he thought it was a great idea. He wouldn't put a Santa Claus suit on. But he said, okay, you know, I'll be a part of it. So what's significant about that picture, that was the first time he met with those neighborhood kids, but it launched a spirit of support for children in public housing, and we were responsible for it. So I love that picture. It has meaning for me.
Inside her office, Zernona shared more of her thoughts and memories of Dr. King.
I think that Martin Luther King's spirit was an infusion for young people to get up and do something. And, you know, he said, Dr. King said, that we've got to have moments in our life that we go out and do something that has meaning to the point that we're willing to die for it. So I saw the picture in my mind that those young people were saying, we're tired of being shot up in their schools, feeling unsafe. We're going to do something about this gun control. And I saw Martin Luther King again.
You know, Zernona, a little later in the show, we're going to talk to the great actor Clifton Powell, who played Dr. King in Selma, Lord Selma. And he shared something with me that I want to ask you about. He told me that he thinks Dr. King would be disappointed at the rate of change in this country. And I wonder how much closer you think we are to Dr. King's conception of the beloved community.
I know he would be pleased to see those young people. But in reality, the March for Change had some results, but he would be disappointed if he were here today. He would be reminded of the actor who rehearses his lines, trying to get his part perfected and get it right so he can go to the stage and do his delivery. The musician will concertize and rehearse and practice and practice until she got it right and then go to perform. And he would say, you all been practicing on this 50 years after I left and you still don't have it right yet? I think that's what he would ask. You don't have it yet? Because you see, when we think about all the wonderful progress we made, and we did, through Dr. King's efforts and others, we got the Fair Housing Bill, we got the right to vote, and people stayed home, by the way. So he made and was responsible for a lot of the progress we've made. But we still haven't gotten there yet. We have not gotten what he called the beloved community. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we love everybody. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we'll treat everybody right. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we'll feed the hungry and clothe the naked. Every time the issues come up, we got some opposition. So his work has not been finished. And when I got the information that this last national election, where we had the lowest minority turnout in, what they said, 18 years or so, I was just sick, because I'm seeing every day men walk around today who shed blood. Dr. C.T. Vivian was down at the courthouse in Alabama trying to get us registered to vote. Didn't get the vote, trying to just get registered to vote, not to burn the building down, trying to register to vote. Finally got a Voting Rights Act where we can vote now. How could people stay in bed? Because I see the blood still running down his face where he was beaten by officers of the police force when they were just trying to get us registered. We have the right. We're not exercising it. If Dr. King were here today, he would just ask the questions, why not?
Do people today have a full enough understanding of who Dr. King was and what the struggle was at root level?
No. I saw an article where a mother was trying to figure out how she could get the message over to her 9-year-old daughter when she asked her daughter, do you know what happened to Dr. King? She said, yeah, he did wrong and they killed him. And she was just really devastated because she didn't think they were that far behind in getting the message across in her own house. And so she said she had to do something fast. But I think some people, you know, considered that the fact he must have done something wrong and they killed him. But you see, we had the FBI, you know, a high-level official in our country, just staying on Dr. King and making him a bad guy because that's what he wanted. So when you put enough information out there and circulate it well as J. Edgar Hoover did, there are people who believe he must have done something wrong to stay on him so closely and then make him such a guy that you kill him. So not enough people know what he was going through.
We talk about the assassination, but let me ask you, why was he assassinated?
There was, you know, a strong feeling that he was disturbing the country. And of course he was, I guess, when you think about it. He was an annoyance to a lot of people. You know, what's he doing now, they would ask. What now? And the thought of, you know, all Dr. King would do is put out there a thought like we're planning for the March on Washington. I even said, oh, listen, they're not going to want you in Washington tearing up that pretty green grass, you know. We think of Dr. King's presence as being destructive. And then there were those in the South where he started with the movement who said that he would come to our town, tear it up, and then leave. That wasn't the case. And I was just reading an article, I didn't know this until just recently, that the mayor of Memphis said to him after the first phase of the sanitation workers' strike, they said, Dr. King, and it's in the documentary that's coming up next week. He said, the mayor said, Dr. King, you know, we know more about our city than you do. We didn't need you coming out here destroying the tranquility of the town or something to that effect. And I want to ask you, why did you come to Memphis? And I had never known this, but Dr. King said, you know, to be honest, I was misled. But I'm here now. And I've seen some of the inequities that they're restless about. And he raised his voice, I'm here to stay until we get all of that change, until you get equity, treat people right, work them and pay them. I'm staying until we get those things corrected. Now, that was kind of a prevailing mood in a lot of cities, that he's coming to our town, tear it up, and then he's going back home. And so there were a lot of people who felt that his presence was a destructive presence.
How would you describe his bearing, his presence for young people now who don't have that, who don't know that, who don't have a sense of it, really?
The man was committed. I always tell people the one thing when I'm asked, what do you remember most and best about him? I said, I remember and admired most about him is that he practiced what he preached. He preached nonviolence and practiced it. He preached loving everybody, and he did. And that's how he and Stokely Carmichael had their first separation, because Stokely said, I'm sick of these white people. You know, they weren't right then, they're not right now, and they ain't gonna be right in the future, so I'm sick of them. Dr. King said, we can't do without white people. They're part of our America. They're part of our world. That God created each of us in his own image, and underneath the skin, we're all the same.
That was my conversation with Zernona Clayton, a close advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his family. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Today we pay tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., assassinated 50 years ago in Memphis, Tennessee. Since his death, several movies have featured him both as a character and as a subject. The Boy King told the story of his youth.
Today my heart cries out in many voices. Each voice is distinct, and each voice pleads for a change from this evil system of segregation. My heart cries out in my mother's voice. She reminds me of all the love I've enjoyed since birth. For despite injury and insult, my mother still put love in my heart.
The Boy King, a production of Atlanta's WSB-TV, it originally aired in 1986 and won the Peabody Award, broadcasting's most prestigious honor. I recently spoke to the film's producer, Judy Cairo, and its director, Bill Parrott.
Even today, the film still holds up in that we still are part of that legacy that's going on and continuing to grow as time passed. So to see, be part of something that didn't die, that continues to live, is remarkable.
Judy, tell me about the film, how the project came to be.
I'll tell you how that came about is telling you how the film came about. So I was working at the time in local programming, as a producer for WSB-TV, and it was to be the first national holiday for Dr. King. And I was given the opportunity to, they told me, come up with something unique, yeah. Something fresh, something out of the box. We could have done a documentary, we could have done a parade, we could have done a telethon, we could have done just about anything. But I'd seen this play, The Boy King, at a local theater that Rand Hopkins had written. And I thought, well, I've never seen the story of what inspired Dr. King as a child. And I approached the playwright, Rand Hopkins, and said, would you be interested in adapting this into a television program, a movie? And he was excited and came on board and pitched it to WSB, the station, and they were very supportive. In fact, they went and found an additional investor, All American Television, so that we could do it on a bigger scale than what we had been doing with our other documentaries and things.
What do you think has changed the most since 1968?
Well, I think we've made tremendous progress. You know, still some things to done, but you know, we've had almost in every capacity out there in terms of performance or careers and thing has been elevated. So there's aspiration for a child to. When I grew up, there was no, you know, Jackie Robinson was who I could aspire to, but I could never aspire to a Secretary of State or a Secretary of whatever the secretaries are, or to be president.
Much less president, sure.
Much less president. So right now we stand that we can actually show to a young Black kid, you can be anything.
Judy, the same question for you. Change. What's changed the most dramatic change since 68?
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to mention is the fact that I had experience spending time professionally here in Atlanta, and then I moved to Los Angeles for 23, 24 years, and now I'm actually back and spending time in both cities. But one of the things, being here in Dr. King's city was so impactful on me as a professional, and I took it with me. I put it in my suitcase when I drove across country, because we, through WSB, through just the culture of the city of Atlanta, were so proud of what he had done and the changes that he had brought about. We were so aware in our programming that diversity was important. You needed to tell everyone's stories. And when I went to Los Angeles, I didn't find that as much. I didn't find that mindset when you're casting movies. I didn't see people talking about how do we achieve diversity in this movie. I was, you know, there 23 years ago. That has changed. Now, finally, people are saying it's important, it's better for the project, it's better for the audience, it's better for the world. Everything about what we do is it's important that we have representation of both gender, every race, that we're better together. And I always had that seed in my brain.
That's Judy Cairo and Bill Parrott. They produced and directed the 1986 made-for-TV movie The Boy King. Selma, Lord Selma premiered in 1999. The film highlighted King's time in Selma. Fighting for equal rights, award-winning actor Clifton Powell joins me this morning to talk about his portrayal of King in that movie. Clifton,
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you on the program.
I'm glad to be here on such a wonderful and tragic occasion.
Sure.
Because honoring the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death to me is tragic.
Mm.
But we have to honor him because he's such a great man. When you really get into doing your research, not to get too long-winded here, but...
Take your time.
Some of the research that I uncovered after I played Dr. King was just simply spellbounding in terms of how they pulled his African-American detail off of him when he was in Memphis, how he was scheduled to be put in another hotel which was not overlooking the city or the streets that could easily be a target. And, you know, some of the things that I've learned is it's been incredible. But 50 years, I can't believe it's been 50 years.
When was the last time you watched Selma, Lord Selma?
You know, that's a great question. I was channel surfing and came across, I'm not sure if it was on BET or one of the networks, I caught Selma, Lord Selma. And, you know, the thing that really hit me was how courageous the young kids were. You know, I mean, I'm seeing the young kids getting out now with Parkland and the shooting in Sacramento and the shooting in Maryland, right outside of your hometown, my hometown. And, but, you know, Dr. King employed the young people because he knew that they would have a voice. And it's something scary about trying to turn a water hose on a 10 or 11-year-old kid that he knew would send this whole country into shock. So it was really interesting watching it again.
How do you take on a portrayal?
Ooh, man, that's a good question.
Like the role of portraying Dr. King. How do you even approach that?
Man.
You don't want to imitate the man. You want to capture the essence of the man. You don't want to do an imitation.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. If we watch Ray and we watch Jamie Foxx do Ray, it was almost like you were watching Ray.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I think for me, if I really break down all the things that have happened to me in my career that should have happened, that didn't happen for certain reasons, because I'm kind of a strong African-American man, and at the time that I was coming through, if you were my complexion, it was hard to, you know, other than Sidney Poitier before Wesley, it was rough. I read an article in Hollywood. It was called Black Hollywood, White Hollywood, and there was an article about Wesley Snipes, and it was from his white agent's perspective. And he sent Wesley in for a role, and they called him and said, "Don't send anybody darker than Denzel." And I've lost roles. I lost a role for a big TV movie, and the producers just told me the networks thought I was going to scare everybody. I was so dark. But it was a different time. Yeah. You know, I'm loving to see all the diversity on television now. I remember back in our day on soap operas, you didn't see anybody with dreads or different types of haircuts. So, you know, and I often not talk about some of the things that I've gone through that's kept my career at a certain point, because I don't play the race card.
Right.
But I know what has been stopped and what has been blocked, and I don't have any bitterness about that. But when something like a Dr. King comes down the line, my picture came across Reuben Cannon's desk. And he said, "Cliff, we called you in, but I'm not exactly sure why, because you play tough guys all the time." And so what I was saying about Hollywood, Black Hollywood, White Hollywood, is that if you are, I don't know if you remember Avery Brooks and A Man Called Hawk.
Sure.
But when, you know, it's changing now.
Yeah.
But back in my day, if you were strong and sturdy, dark and strong, it was rough. You playing tough guys. And, you know, so when I first got there, I played a lot of tough guys. But I always wanted to play Dr. King. I saw a guy in college who played Dr. King, and he nailed him. I said, "Man, I think I can do that." So I come into the audition. No, my manager called me. She said, "They want to bring you in for Selma, Lord Selma." I said, "For who?" She said, "Dr. King." And I thought I was going to pass out. Because to me, if I've never done anything else than just Selma, Lord Selma, play Dr. King, I'm good with it.
So let's hear you at work in this scene from Selma, Lord Selma.
Mm-hmm.
You're giving an inspirational speech as Dr. King.
Wow.
"We're not gonna let any cross burning stop us.
That's right.
We're not gonna let any hatred stop us. We're not gonna let nothing turn us around.
No, sir.
We're moving on.
The light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine."
watching you as you're listening. What are you thinking? And now you're smiling.
You know, every time I hear that, I'm thinking, I could have done it better.
Clifton.
We're not going to let any cross burnings turn us around. So, you know, all actors always think they can do better. You know, Charles Burnett, who directed that, was just such a wonderful guy. Early on, we had some problems with Disney. They thought that I was not deliberately, but making the sermons too slow. And I said to Charles, I said, you know, maybe these guys didn't study Disney. I mean, Dr. King.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Dr. King was a very deliberate speaker.
Absolutely.
And so he said, well, you know, if it is any solace to you, they don't want to see any blood on Bloody Sunday. So oftentimes when people see stuff on television, it gets watered down. But I think Charles Burnett and I worked really closely to get my version of Dr. King mixed with the Disney version of Dr. King, which probably was a little bit more faster. And,
right.
You know, and then Bloody Sunday, and they didn't want certain colors. So I think he did a great job of mixing the two and finding a great balance so that we could feel some of the tension in that movie.
Right.
But it never really went to where actually it could have gone.
So you've mentioned Bloody Sunday. It's the culminating event of that day, March 7th, 1965. And it was the moment the Alabama state troopers tore into hundreds of nonviolent protesters,
yes,
right,
sir.
Attempting
yes,
to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. I wonder how it feels for you. It feels crazy for me, I got to tell you. And I was there to think that 50 years later, the first African-American president is there in Selma, marking that anniversary by walking across the bridge with Congressman John Lewis, President George W. Bush, the late Amelia Boynton Robinson, right? Have a listen to former President Obama speaking at the ceremonies marking the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery marches.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., so many others, the idea of a just America, and a fair America, an inclusive America, and a generous America, that idea ultimately triumphed.
What are your thoughts on that in terms of the historic significance of that moment?
My first day on the set, I was going to my trailer. There were two white cops outside of my trailer. And I I'm a friendly guy. You know, I'm from D.C., Baltimore area, you know, really friendly. I grew up to speak to people. And every morning I spoke to them. And every morning they looked right at me like I was crazy. So one day I came in and, you know, one of the African-American cops said to me, he said, Mr. Powell, you know, those cops are Klan. They're not going to speak to you. I said, wow. And every day that I walked on the set, people were like, Dr. King, Dr. King, Dr. King. So there was a reporter. She said, do you think you embodied the spirit of Dr. King? Do you think you could have gone through what he went through? And I said, ma'am, honestly, I'm an actor who's betraying a man who is probably, to me, one of the most incredible men in the history of America in terms of peace and love. And I am just trying to touch the hem of his garment. And so walking across that bridge and trying to understand what happened that day and the impact of the kind of courage that you have to have to know that at some point this thing could turn crazy. And you're going to get hit with water hoses and billy clubs and beaten down. I told her, I said, I don't have that kind of courage. I'm an actor, and if you hit me with a brick, I'm going to hit you right back with one. You know, and so I really just, even now as I read about Dr. King, I just marvel at how incredibly faithful he was, how incredibly courageous he was under the threat of death every day.
That's actor Clifton Powell. He portrayed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1999 film Selma, Lord Selma. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. This hour, we look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. On the 50th anniversary of his death, we ask what that legacy means for the future of civil rights. My GPB colleague, Leah Fleming, joins us with a variety of views and voices.
Civil rights, what are they to you? Racial equality? Gender equality? What about access to health care? Equal pay for equal work? How about freedom to say what you please and believe what you wish? Have your ideas about civil rights changed? And are there new definitions of civil rights? Well, we are joined for a roundtable discussion to talk about all of that. And we have several guests to do that, including Reverend Gerald Durley. He is the Senior Pastor Emeritus at Providence Missionary Baptist Church. Hello, Reverend.
Good morning.
And then we have Amanda Hollowell. She is a community organizer, and she's based in Savannah. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. How are you guys?
We are well. I've got Avery Jackson in studio. He's an organizer and strategist for ATL Is Ready. Hi, Avery.
Hey, how you doing?
And I've got Devin Springer. He is a journalist, a photographer, and an organizer. Hello.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to start with you first, Reverend Durley. How has the face of the new civil rights movement changed, do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, it's changed quite a bit because of the social media context that they have. When I got into the movement, that was in 1959 and 1960. We did not have the kind of access to the media that they have now. So when we had to move, we had to, in the early civil rights movement, it was a lot of Gestetten machines calling on the phone when we could to organize people. They can push one button now and put 10,000 people into the streets to bring the knowledge about. But the causes are still the same. Freedom, justice for all, equality for all, regardless of one's sexual preference, regardless of one's race or gender. The commonality between the new civil rights organizers and those of us who were in it in the early 60s, it's primarily the same, but the access to information and the ability to get it out is vastly different.
It's a whole new world with that.
A completely different world.
Yeah. What about you, Amanda? What would you say are some of the new civil rights issues?
Not so much new, but more so that are more apparent. So what I'm loving now is that women are more in the forefront of a movement of just about social issues, especially African-American women and women of color, and actually being heard in a way of like, there's those rights and then there's also my rights. And let's acknowledge what the discrepancies are and disparities that we face as women of color. And how do we address those issues without someone having a white guilt feeling, or how do we move the needle forward for a version of equity?
Devin, what would you say are some of the issues?
That hit the nail on the head, right? It's not really that they're new issues. It's more so new issues that are at the focus right now. So a lot of the issues are the same. It's just that they've kind of shifted face. So we still are facing police violence, mass incarceration. Those are two really big ones to organize around.
Would you agree?
Definitely would agree. The only thing that I think I would add is that within the representation, there's a critique of younger folks and folks who don't fit on these traditional margins to criticize the traditional leadership. I mean, particularly in Atlanta, we see, you know, folks taking up the social justice issues and civil rights pursuit. But there's still like a respectability, and there's still like a class status, and there's still like a certain amount of privilege given to certain voices over others. And I think what we're seeing now is that there's organizers and young people and you know, folks who are just open-minded, who are willing to criticize these mechanisms for measuring value, so that we can really get to like relationships that are deeper than just issue-based.
So what I'm hearing all of you say is that there are a number of things about this new civil rights movement that are the same, but there are still so many things that are different that are included in civil rights. It seems like it has expanded the civil rights movement to include a number of things. With you, Reverend Durley, I know that you have actually said that climate change is a civil rights issue.
It very much is, because when you look at what we're doing now, when you look all over the world, when you start talking about what carbon dioxide is doing to the air and the gas house effect, what has happened now is that these are affecting urban areas and rural areas. When we're suing in many cities right now, I'm working with the water keepers, with Bobby Kenny and I, we travel around the world, and Ted Turner, trying to bring up awareness that we are creating this by burning fossil fuel in the air. And now we've got an administration that is insensitive to what it's doing to people by going back into the oceans. We understand the acidity that is in the oceans that's causing the glaciers to melt, the oceans to rise. We also understand the carbon dioxide. And also with fracking, we've got methane coming into the air. So that's negatively, disproportionately impacting those that we're called to serve. That's a civil right. Everybody has a constitutional right to clean water and clean air. So therefore, we've got to now stand up and march and speak out to that the same way we did some years ago when it comes to a civil and human rights, because it's always against the least, the left out, the lost, and those that cannot speak up for themselves.
I'm wondering if you all are concerned, though, because there are so many different things that encompass the civil rights movement today, that some of these issues might actually get lost in the mix. What do you think, Avery?
I think that's when we talk about intersections. Like, we can talk about one thing and still talk about the intersections of all the systems together. So I think when we talk about, you know, climate change and we talk about access to healthcare, we can still talk about the ways that, you know, really it's a system of anti-blackness, right? It's a system when we look across, you know, the institutions, the bureaucratic, you know, systems that have been built by this country. We constantly see black people, you know, taking the brunt of the cost, paying the cost for someone else's benefit.
Amanda, I know you experienced quite a few intersections when you went to the Women's March in January. What were some of your observations?
Well, I mean, intersectionality has been around. Angela Davis spoke about it in one of her books. And I grafted myself towards that because, like, one of the hardest things that we're all facing is that just because you've been wrong doesn't mean your wrong is greater than my wrong. And with the Women's March and when we localized and did it here in Savannah, it was really hard to get people to move forward in their thinking because they were like, what about the environment? And then what about, you know, criminal justice reform? And I was like, all these are directly interconnected, you guys. And you need to bring this down to a very simple understanding of what it is. And it's social justice. And it's how do we create this more of a, not a salad, but a melting pot in our communities and having these tough conversations and people confronting issues and ideas about themselves and how they view the world, but how can we move forward as a community?
And that's when it's so critical that we find ourselves living in silos. This is mine and this is yours. And nothing can work until we find, as we've talked about, the intersectionality. And intersectionality is and the separation is built on a primary word called fear. When you've got people afraid of another, then you've got fear. And fear is predicated upon ignorance. Ignorance is not stupidity, but if I'm ignorant of you, if I'm ignorant of your cause, if I'm ignorant of what you say and what you do and how you dress, then I am fearful. And when I'm fearful, then I must protect my own. And this protectionist attitude sits all of these silos. And in reality, we're all about the same thing, trying to find a quality of life for all people.
But I'm wondering, while that really does sound good, I want to point to something and get you all to talk about this. A concern that I've seen that has been discussed on social media, it comes from a recent experience. After the Parkland, Florida school shooting, there were protests, there were school walkouts. And one of the images that concerned a few people was of a white student, and she had her hands up, and she had written on each of her hands in black ink, "Don't shoot." So as you remember, that hands up, don't shoot, really became a rallying cry for protesters after the 2014 police shooting death of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson by the name of Michael Brown. Now, she could have been pointing to that, but, you know, without interviewing her, I have no idea. But it does bring up the question, are you concerned about some civil rights messages kind of getting lost in the mix with so many different issues and so many people entering into this movement? I mean, Parkland was obviously about to protest gun violence and to ask for reasonable gun laws in this country. But what happened in Ferguson is and Sacramento is different. What do you think?
I mean, I definitely think that's an issue. It's less about different issues and topics getting lost in the mix. I think they're often co-opted, right, by these larger nonprofits and corporations. I mean, we just saw Pepsi last year had a commercial where they were just pretty much taking, you know, all of the activism of 2017 and using it to sell a product, for example. So I think it's less about different topics and issues getting lost in the mix, because our job as organizers is to make sure that our cause doesn't get lost, right? That's just what we do.
What would you say about that, Amanda?
Not to knock those people who are moving on pure energy right now in the movement, but we've got a lot of organizers who are untrained and don't know what nonviolent protest is and don't know what co-opting means. I recently had an incident where my work was co-opted by a white man, and they were like, he did all this work. And I was like, that's weird, because that's all my name on everything. But I didn't get upset. I found an ally, corrected the story. I think with this new generation or like this new form of civil rights, that's the challenge, right? Back then, you had identified leadership. You had an actual game plan of how we were going to do this. We march today. We work on policy on Thursday. We're in the churches on Sunday registering people to vote. And it was a common collective of these were our action steps. Now, everyone is everywhere, right? And there is no like common thread yet. But it's coming. I think it's coming.
Well, I would actually want to, you know, more explicitly say that I think it's an extension of white supremacist capitalism, right? Like, I think when we saw Pepsi using activism as a means to sell product, like, that was more than just weird. It was actually, like, a capitalist tactic on how to, like, you know, extract the livelihood and the creations of people who honestly are suffering to the benefit of, like, these larger corporations whose mechanisms are in direct contradictions of our quality of life. And then I want to say also, like, I think the way that we have been seeing this national mainstream support of young white people, you know, talking about school shootings, that is what white supremacy is, right? We value mm-hmm. the voices and the pain and the lives mm-hmm. of white people over people of color. And that's exactly what we see every time we see a march that's led in mass with white people in response to, you know, harm done to white bodies. But when we think about, you know, how violence has always been the experience of black people in this country, and violence mm-hmm. has always been the experience for young black people in inner city neighborhoods, like in rural neighborhoods, right? Like, and state violence, like, is by design in this country, like, then the conversation gets a little too hardy for people. And so mm-hmm. people begin to backtrack. And that, to me, like, when we start talking about privilege, because there's always the option for white people in this country to exit the conversation about, like, state violence. But when we look at black people and young black people and people of color, that's not necessarily the case. Like, we always have to be in conversation about suffering. We always have to be in conversations about, you know, violence. And it gets really uncomfortable for a lot of people.
As I said, I'm 76 years old now.
Yeah.
I started in the movement a long time. I went to jail 22 times, and I have seen them co-opting our movement mm-hmm. for years. Mm-hmm. But I have seen them. I'm so glad now that even the young people are co-opting. I remember several years ago when I was dean at Clark, several students said, "Why are you all going to march? That's old-timey. That makes no sense. Why get out there? Why talk about civil disobedience? Just get a better education." But they took the movement, and now they're taking what we did mm-hmm. and doing it all over the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to see, because if we can get, when we had the march in 1963, we looked across and we were surprised with the Jews and the Muslims and so many people coming. And initially, even the president, he wouldn't give us protection. I mean, Kennedy. So consequently, mm-hmm. the more the masses can come and see, but we've got to be strong enough to understand that we still have, as you talked about, we've gone through the suffering, we've gone through the jails, we've gone through the pain, and the allies that we can get, and we can weed out those that are phony, those that are perpetrating, but we need as many as we can to make our message strong. Right now in America, we're on the back docket. We're not a dreamer, we're not a DACA, mm-hmm. we're not an immigrant, we don't have a wall to put up, mm-hmm. so we've got to get as many allies as we can to move ahead.
I'm in conversation with Reverend Gerald Durley, Amanda Hollowell, Avery Jackson, and Devin Springer, and I want to ask you all about lessons learned and where do we go from here in terms of this new civil rights movement?
Really, it's all about local community organizing. And it's about people realizing that movement and strategy is not external of their lives. It's not external of your body. Like, it's how we live our everyday lives. And we have to be willing to be critical of the people who we are uncomfortable being critical of.
Is that what's happening with you, Amanda, down in Savannah?
A lot of people thought they were, you know, they created fire here recently, and I was just like, no, there's some people who were actually really involved in the civil rights movement who did sit-ins and the beach in here. We need to engage them. And what I like is that I'm trying to remind people that we stand on the shoulders of folks who gave their lives, right? So be careful in this movement, because we're talking about someone's life.
Mm. What about you, Devin? What do you think?
I mean, I think looking at the past, one of the things was they were very big on community education and community political education, right? People like Ella Baker, for example, were known for having this way of being this link between the elders and the young people of the movement. And I think one of the things we're lacking right now is finding those links, those places in between where we can learn from the elders and critique them for where their shortcomings were, and then teach them as well. That's a big part of it. I think moving forward, you know, like Avery said, localizing, and it's a sense of localizing your organizing and activism so how you can help the greater good outward, mm-hmm. right? So if Atlanta is getting strong, Atlanta can help someone else. But if Atlanta's weak and we're not taking care of Atlanta, how are we going to help someone in Palestine, or how are we going to help someone in Chicago or Ferguson, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like this, it's a lot of dualities that we have to have moving forward. We have to help ourselves to help others.
Reverend Durley.
Well, I think I heard it briefly, the three things that kept us going: organize, strategize, and then mobilize. When I talk about mm-hmm. organizing something and a group looks at me and says, I'll come to the meeting after I leave my fraternity or my sorority meeting, I say, you're out. You're not willing to sacrifice mm-hmm. nor risk. So any meeting that we come to organize, what are you willing to sacrifice? We were willing to sacrifice going to jail. We were willing to sacrifice getting kicked out of school. If my mother got in the way, she'd have to step aside. I was willing to sacrifice. We were willing. So if we could infuse that, like we're talking about the elders to the younger, what are you willing to sacrifice?
All right, Reverend Gerald Durley, you are Pastor Emeritus at Providence Missionary Baptist Church. Amanda Hollowell, local community organizer in Savannah. Avery Jackson, organizer and strategist for ATL Is Ready. And Devin Springer, journalist, photographer, and organizer. Thank you to all of you for this conversation.
That's GPB's Leah Fleming.